1933, denoting the country's major ethnic regions. P stands for Punjab, A for Afghan, referring to Pashtuns, K for Kashmir, S for Sindh, and Tan for Balochistan. While Pashtuns have politically dominated Afghanistan, Punjabis have politically dominated Pakistan. Representing somewhere around half the population, Punjabis control Pakistan's famous military as well as most state institutions. Punjabis are also intensely ethnocentric. They speak Punjabi, and they are highly endogamous, typically marrying other Punjabis, often their own cousins. This practice is common even among Punjabis in Great Britain, where first-cousin marriages among Pakistanis are leading to an appalling and absolutely unacceptable incidence of disability among children, as a Lahore-born member of the House of Lords recently warned. Ever since independence, the Pakistani government has viewed the Pashtuns as a major threat. This is because there are a lot of Pashtuns in Pakistan. In fact, although Pashtuns comprise only 15% of Pakistan's total population, there are actually more Pashtuns in Pakistan, about 28 million, than in Afghanistan, about 15 million. Worse, most of Pakistan's Pashtuns live clustered near the Afghanistan border, along the Durand Line, which British colonialists drew in 1893, and which Pashtuns scorn as illegitimate. Indeed, Pashtuns on both sides of the border cross the Durand Line at will, which is not difficult given that the line runs through rugged terrain practically impossible to police. A common saying among Pashtuns holds that you cannot separate water with a stick, and many Pashtuns in Pakistan still identify themselves as Afghan. Pakistani fear of Pashtun nationalism and irredentism grew even more acute after 1971, when Pakistan's Bengalis broke away in a violent, successful attempt to establish Bangladesh as an independent country. Pakistan's Punjabi elites were determined not to let that happen again with the Pashtuns. The Soviet Union's Vietnam. In 1978, Afghanistan's president was overthrown and brutally murdered in his palace along with most of his family members, their bodies thrown in a ditch. Although pro-communist rebels led the coup, it took not only the United States, but also the Soviet Union by surprise. According to one historian of the Soviet Union, even the KGB learned about the leftist coup ex post facto. Fortunately for the United States, the Soviet Union was as ethnically blind as we were during the Cold War, similarly viewing world events in terms of a grand battle between communism and capitalism. After the 1978 coup, the Soviet ambassador to Afghanistan tried valiantly to interpret what had happened in orthodox Marxist terms. In a letter to Moscow, he explained that the previous government had accelerated the contradictions of capitalism, leading to a proletariat revolution sooner than anyone had expected. This assessment bore no resemblance to reality. There was no proletariat in Afghanistan. The coup was the culmination of a festering feud between one faction dominated by rural Pashtuns, who were behind the coup, and another dominated by urban Tajiks. The new government in Afghanistan was a disaster. While its leaders might have been nominally communist, they were also, first and foremost, Pashtun nationalists who viewed Afghan as synonymous with Pashtun. To consolidate power, they embarked on a campaign of terror, hunting down rival religious and tribal leaders and torturing and executing more than 50,000 people. The Soviet Union's new Afghan clients became totally unmanageable. Moscow feared that the growing turmoil would bring anti-communist, pro-American forces to power. In December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. "It'll be over in 3 to 4 weeks," Leonid Brezhnev told the Soviet ambassador to the United States. 9 years later, the Soviets left Afghanistan with their tail between their legs, having been defeated by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen. At the time, Washington policymakers were thrilled. "We had beaten our rival superpower practically on their own turf." But the Soviet defeat was a Pyrrhic victory for America. The United States as Pakistan's geopolitical pawn. The Soviet invasion of 1979 alarmed the Carter administration. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, was simultaneously hopeful that Moscow had overreached, but fearful of a reprise of 1956, when the Soviets invaded Hungary and crushed the resistance there, or of 1968, when they did the same in Czechoslovakia. At the same time, we were still stinging from Vietnam, and direct military involvement was out of the question. So we opted to covertly arm the anti-Soviet Afghan Mujahideen through Pakistan. All decisions about who got the most guns, the most money, the most power were left to Pakistan's anti-communist dictator, General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq. In other words, we outsourced our Cold War policy in Afghanistan to Pakistan. In turn, Pakistan took us for a ride, making the United States its geopolitical pawn. Pakistan knew exactly how to manipulate ethnic politics in Afghanistan. Zia's strategy was classic divide and conquer. The Pashtun people are not homogenous. On the contrary, they are notoriously internally fragmented, with a maze of hundreds of smaller tribes and clans, many with long-standing rivalries and conflicts. Indeed, the Pashtuns are the world's largest tribally organized society. Although virtually all Pashtuns are Sunni Muslims, some tribes, often rural, are more religious, while others, typically urban, are more secular. Zia shrewdly favored and empowered Islamist Pashtuns, splitting them off from moderates and allying them with his own Islamist regime. He built madrasas throughout the Pashtun regions. These Islamic schools cultivated an extremist and virulent fundamentalism among young Pashtun men. As former Afghan President Hamid Karzai would later put it, "Pakistan set out to destroy Pashtun nationalism by Islamicizing Pakistani Pashtuns and killing Afghan Pashtun nationalists. Pakistan's goal was to have Afghanistan dominated by radical Islam." U.S. policymakers, focused on the battle against communism, barely knew anything about the Pashtuns. On the contrary, the United States romanticized the Pakistan-supported Afghan Mujahideen as soldiers fighting for the free world. Congressman Charlie Wilson had floor-to-ceiling framed photographs of Mujahideen warriors in heroic pose hung on his office wall. Even in the face of the stunning upheaval of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 and the taking of American hostages there, U.S. foreign policy in Afghanistan never saw the potent, anti-American, anti-Western group identity fueling the Islamic fundamentalist fighters. Fixated on the Cold War, we were heedless of the monster we were helping to create. Between 1980 and 1992, we funneled through Pakistan almost $5 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, including heavy machine guns, explosives, anti-aircraft cannons, wireless interception equipment, and 2,300 shoulder-fired Stinger missiles to anti-Soviet Mujahideen fighters, paying no attention to whom we were arming. The recipients included the likes of Mullah Muhammad Omar, who would eventually land on America's most wanted list and become the Taliban's intensely anti-Western supreme commander. It's not an exaggeration to say that the United States was in significant part responsible for the rise of the Taliban and for turning Afghanistan into a hospitality suite for Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda militants. After the Soviet withdrawal in 1989, Afghanistan descended into years of brutal civil war. The U.S. government lost interest in the country, even as Pakistan and Saudi Arabia each continued to aggressively finance and arm their favored Afghan jihadist leaders. In 1996, America was caught completely off guard when a group of barefooted mullahs, calling themselves the Taliban, captured Kabul and took over two-thirds of Afghanistan. The Taliban, playing the ethnic card. Afghanistan in the early 90s was lawless. Warlords ruled practically every city and town. Racketeers and drug mafias reaped enormous profits. Kidnappings, extortion, and rape, including of young girls, were rampant. One reason so many war-weary Afghans initially supported the Taliban was that it provided security where previously chaos reigned, even if security under the Taliban came with a strict Islamic dress code and bans on television, music, cards, kite flying, and most sports. But the Taliban was able to provide security, to amass power and popular support broad and deep enough to establish law and order because of its appeal to Pashtun ethnic identity. For hundreds of years, the ruler of Afghanistan was always Pashtun. After the fall of the Afghan monarchy in 1973, the Soviet invasion, and years of civil war, Pashtun dominance was suddenly upended. In the early 1990s, much of the country was controlled by members of the Tajik minority. The Pashtuns had lost control of Kabul, the nation's capital, where Burhanuddin Rabbani, a Tajik, was now president. They had lost control of the state bureaucracy, to the extent that it was still functioning. The Pashto language, once dominant in the nation's government-run television, radio, and newspapers, had lost status and declined dramatically. The Pashtuns had even lost control of their core power base, the Afghan military, which had fragmented, leaving non-Pashtun generals in command over the remaining units. As a result, deep resentment and fear of marginalization, of being eclipsed, had become widespread among Pashtuns of all different clans and tribes. Into this breach stepped the Taliban. Virtually all of the Taliban leadership, and most of its rank and file, are Pashtuns. Typically Gilzai Pashtuns, from the lowest socioeconomic rung of society. The Taliban uses Pashto as its exclusive language of communication, and their Pashtun identity is also obvious from their dress and individual behavior. The promise to restore Pashtun dominance in Afghanistan was a key part of the Taliban's rise to power. Going from village to village, clan to clan, Taliban leaders combined their call for a simpler, purer Islam with appeals to Pashtun pride and resentment, offering Pashtuns a chance to reclaim their proper place. As Seth Jones writes, "The Taliban's strategy was innovative and ruthlessly effective. Unlike the Soviets, they focused their initial efforts on bottom-up efforts in rural Afghanistan, especially the Pashtun South. They approached tribal leaders and militia commanders, as well as their rank-and-file supporters, and they offered to restore Pashtun control of Kabul, which was run by the Tajik Rabbani. It was a strategy accomplished on a very personal level. Taliban leaders who spoke the local dialect traveled to the Pashtun villages and district centers." This is also why the Taliban was able to take over Afghanistan so quickly, catching the U.S. government unaware. The Taliban's Pashtun identity allowed them to sweep through the Pashtun areas relatively easily, in many cases without a shot being fired. It was primarily in non-Pashtun areas that the Taliban met with strong resistance. In the words of the influential Pashtun thinker Anwar al-Haq Ahadi, who later became head of Afghanistan's central bank under President Hamid Karzai, for many Pashtuns, fears of Pashtun marginalization were more significant than the fall of communism. The rise of the Taliban generated optimism among the Pashtuns about a reversal of their decline. The Taliban's leader, Mullah Muhammad Omar, understood better than anyone the art of Afghan tribal politics. As Steve Cole writes in Ghost Wars, the poorly educated, one-eyed cleric from an undistinguished Pashtun clan was an unlikely heir to Pashtun glory. But Omar was a master at interweaving fundamentalist Islam with Pashtun pride and symbolism. On the day he assumed leadership in the spring of 1996, he convened in Kandahar an audience of more than 1,000 Pashtun leaders and religious scholars. There, he called them to the tomb of the great Pashtun king Ahmad Shah Durrani, who, after unifying the Pashtun tribes in 1747, had gone on to occupy Delhi and extend Afghan rule as far as Tibet. As Omar figuratively wrapped himself in Durrani's mantle, he climbed on the roof of the adjacent mosque and literally wrapped himself in the supposed cloak of the Holy Prophet. The crowd exulted and named him Commander of the Faithful. Ultimately, the Taliban never succeeded in unifying Afghanistan's Pashtuns. In part, this is because Pakistan's divide-and-conquer policies worked exactly as planned. More moderate, pro-Western Pashtuns found the Taliban's fanaticism increasingly repulsive. The Taliban's close ties with Pakistan also undermined its appeal to ordinary Afghans who feared the Pakistanization of their country. Nevertheless, the Taliban's Pashtun identity and its readiness to exploit Pashtun ethno-nationalism have been essential to its appeal, drawing large numbers of Pashtuns into its orbit from a surprising range of tribal, economic, and, to some extent, ideological backgrounds. The ethnic side of the Taliban was even starker for the country's non-Pashtuns, who were systematically targeted. In 1998, for example, the Taliban massacred 2,000 Uzbeks and Hazaras, who, for their part, had massacred Taliban Pashtuns in 1997, and tried to starve another 160,000. The Taliban also persecuted and killed Tajiks, particularly in the country's rural areas. The United States never saw the ethnic side of the Taliban. In the 80s and early 90s, we saw the Mujahideen only as anti-communist, and therefore as friends. Needless to say, we quickly soured on our freedom fighter allies, especially after we learned that they weren't allowing girls to attend school, had slaughtered entire communities, and had barbarically destroyed the ancient Buddha statues in the Bamiyan Valley. Osama bin Laden officially launched al-Qaeda from Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, announcing to the world that it was the duty of every Muslim to kill Americans in any country in which it is possible to do it. But when it became clear that the Taliban were not our friends, specifically when they refused to turn over bin Laden after he took down the World Trade Center, we simply traded in our Cold War lens for an anti-terrorist or anti-Islamist one. We recast the Taliban as a bunch of cave-dwelling mullahs and once again failed to see the central importance of ethnicity. The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. In October 2001, just a few weeks after the 9/11 attacks, on a wave of collective grief and anger, we sent troops to Afghanistan. We continued to make terrible miscalculations, repeatedly underestimating the importance of ethnic and tribal identity. Impressively, we toppled the Taliban in just 75 days. But, in doing so, we joined forces with the Northern Alliance, led by Tajik and Uzbek warlords and widely viewed as anti-Pashtun. According to counterterrorism expert Hassan Abbas, the Uzbek warlord Abdul Rashid Dostum, one of the Northern Alliance's commanders, mercilessly killed thousands of Taliban foot soldiers, even though many had already surrendered. Dostum was known for such tendencies, but on this occasion he did it on the payroll of the CIA. In another horrific episode, Dostum's soldiers packed thousands of Taliban prisoners in shipping containers for transport with no food or water. Although Dostum later insisted that the deaths were unintentional, hundreds suffocated in the containers. More were killed when Dostum's guards shot into the containers. The bodies were buried in a mass grave. About 1,500 Taliban prisoners died. Most Pashtuns, including many who were not sympathetic to the Taliban, saw Dostum's brutality as an act of ethnic revenge. For them, he was an anti-Pashtun mass killer. When Dostum became one of America's warlords, it didn't exactly endear us to the Pashtuns. We compounded the problem with the post-Taliban government we helped set up, alienating Pashtuns all over the country by appearing to exclude them while favoring their rival ethnic groups. At a heavily U.S.-influenced post-war conference convened in Bonn to determine the future of Afghanistan, Afghanistan was represented by a team consisting primarily of Uzbeks, Tajiks, and Hazaras from the Northern Alliance, along with a smaller number of exiled Pashtuns. American policy in Afghanistan was effectively to exclude almost anyone remotely associated with the Taliban, including thousands of more moderate Pashtuns who were connected to the Taliban through clan ties or who had worked with the Taliban without necessarily accepting its jihadist ideology. Moreover, the United States was seen, to some extent correctly, as turning over the country's key positions of power to the Pashtuns' arch-rival ethnic group, the Tajiks, many of them known for corruption and patronage. Although President Hamid Karzai was a Pashtun, Tajiks filled most of the top ministry positions, such as Army Chief of Staff, Director of Military Intelligence, Army Inspector General, and Director of Counter-Narcotics Forces. Only 24% of the population, Tajiks made up 70% of the Army's corps commanders in the new U.S.-supported Afghan National Army. As Tajiks appeared to grow wealthy, while U.S. airstrikes pounded primarily Pashtun regions, a bitter saying spread among Afghan Pashtuns, "They get the dollars, and we get the bullets." Many, who had initially welcomed the U.S. military intervention in 2001, grew increasingly alienated from the new U.S.-backed regime, which has left Pashtuns at the very bottom of global human development. After U.S. and coalition troops defeated the Taliban, actually just sending many of its foot soldiers into hiding in the mountains, we effectively turned our back on the country. With our eyes set on Iraq, we failed to implement any measures ensuring security or basic services for the Afghan people. This was a grave error. One of the Taliban's main strengths was that it had put a stop to the previously rampant extortions, rapes, gang robberies, and abductions, and after the United States routed the Taliban, corruption and lawlessness surged anew. In December 2001, Vice President Cheney declared, "The Taliban is out of business permanently." By 2010, the Taliban had regained control of major swaths of eastern and southern Afghanistan, Despite the United States having spent a staggering $650 billion on the war and sacrificed more than 2,200 American lives. In 2016, U.S. Forces Afghanistan reported that about 43% of the country's districts were either contested or back under insurgent control or influence. In March 2017, the Taliban recaptured a key area in Helmand Province, an area known for opium poppy production that U.S. and British troops had defended at great human cost. According to a CNN security analyst, the Taliban was able to do so, in part because the Taliban have popular support, the government in Kabul doesn't. The further away from Kabul you get, the worse it becomes. Meanwhile, Afghanistan has once again become an epicenter for terrorism, attracting members of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and the Pakistani Taliban, which killed 132 schoolchildren in Peshawar in 2014. From the Cold War through the present day, our foreign policy in Afghanistan has been a colossal failure. In daunting part, this is because we either failed to understand or chose to ignore the country's complex tribal politics. What General Stanley McChrystal said of the NATO-led security forces in 2009 was surely true of the United States as well. We had not sufficiently studied Afghanistan's peoples, whose needs, identities, and grievances vary from province to province and from valley to valley. Consequently, as with Vietnam, nearly every move we made in Afghanistan was practically designed to turn large segments of the population against us. Specifically, we never saw, and never solved, in fact, never really even tried to solve, the Pashtun problem. The Pashtuns see Afghanistan as their country. They founded it and ruled it continuously for more than 200 years. They defeated two world superpowers, the British and the Russians. However much they loathe the Taliban, Pashtuns are not going to support any regime they view as subordinating the Pashtun people to their deeply resented ethnic rivals. Today, there are a host of excellent and insightful books and articles with titles like The Pashtun Dilemma, The Pashtun Problem, and The Pashtun Question, which, hopefully, U.S. foreign policymakers are now paying attention to. But, as always, it's a little late. Chapter 4. Iraq. A group of imams turned up to see me, introducing themselves as Kurds, Arabs, and Turkmen, and both Sunni and Shia. I asked them how I could help. "You know our needs," one retorted. "America would not have invaded without knowing everything about us and what we need." Emma Skye, The Unraveling. You don't kill or capture your way out of an industrial strength insurgency. General David Petraeus. In 2003, U.S. leaders and policymakers thought they had the right foreign policy models for the invasion of Iraq, post-Second World War Germany and Japan. In both countries, we overthrew an authoritarian regime, liberated the populace, democratized, and introduced a liberal constitution, all with extraordinary success, leading to peace and prosperity. As President Bush put it, "There was a time when many said that the cultures of Japan and Germany were incapable of sustaining democratic values." Well, they were wrong. Some say the same of Iraq today. They are mistaken. As a result, the United States invaded Iraq with enormous optimism. "We will help the Iraqi people establish a peaceful and democratic country in the heart of the Middle East," President Bush said, later adding, "The rise of freedom in this vital region will eliminate the conditions that feed radicalism and ideologies of murder and make our nation safer. Similarly, Vice President Cheney predicted that after the United States liberated Iraq, the streets of Basra and Baghdad are sure to erupt in joy, and the freedom-loving peoples of the region will have a chance to promote the values that can bring lasting peace. In the months before the war, CIA analysts were so confident that Iraqis would warmly welcome U.S. soldiers that one operative suggested sneaking hundreds of small American flags into the country for grateful Iraqis to wave at their liberators. Of course, none of this happened. On the contrary, as in Vietnam and Afghanistan, we soon found ourselves in an unwinnable war, hated by the people we were supposedly trying to help. Instead of establishing a shining model of free market democracy in the Middle East, we produced ISIS. The problem was that post-war Japan and Germany were the wrong comparables. From a tribal politics point of view, they could not have been more different from Iraq. Both countries were strikingly ethnically homogeneous. Japan, because it had always been that way, and Germany, because by 1945 it had exterminated most of its non-Aryans. In other words, post-war democratization in both those countries took place in the relative absence of ethnic or religious division. Unfortunately, a much better comparison was staring us right in the face. 1990s Yugoslavia. Like Iraq, Yugoslavia was a multi-ethnic nation, Serbs, Croats, Slovenes, Bosnians, and so on, with a long history of ethnic enmity. To give just one example, Croats, with Nazi support, slaughtered thousands of Serbs in concentration camps in World War II. Yugoslavia had deep religious divides, Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, and Muslims. It had a market-dominant minority, the Croats, who, along with the Slovenes, were far wealthier than the more populous, less economically developed Serbs. It had a relatively weak national identity. Like Iraq, the state of Yugoslavia was created after the First World War. And all this had been held together by the iron hand of a charismatic military dictator, Josip Broz Tito, with considerable success. Under Tito's decades-long rule, although ethnic tensions simmered just below the surface, Yugoslavia's different groups had lived together relatively peaceably, with Serbs and Croats often intermarrying. But when democratization came to Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, the result was not peace and prosperity. It was ethnic demagoguery, ethnic warfare, and ethnic cleansing, a kind of violence not seen in Europe since the Holocaust. Concentration camps appeared. Serbs killed Croats. Croats killed Serbs. Serbs slaughtered Bosnian Muslims. Serbs who had lived as neighbors with Croats for years were suddenly roaring with approval as their leaders shouted, "We will kill Croats with rusty spoons because it will hurt more." Yugoslavia, not Japan or Germany, would have been a far more instructive comparison for Iraq. In 2003, Iraq too was a multi-ethnic nation, with cross-cutting ethno-religious divisions among Sunni Arabs, Shia Arabs, Kurds, and Christians. Although most Kurds in Iraq are also Sunni, I will use the term Sunnis to refer to Sunni Arabs. Iraq, too, was a country with a relatively weak national identity, ruled for decades with an iron fist by a military dictator. And, like Yugoslavia, Iraq had its own equivalent of a market-dominant minority. Sunni minority dominance in Iraq. On the eve of the U.S. invasion, Iraq's roughly 15% Sunni minority dominated the country economically, politically, and militarily. By contrast, Shias comprised the vast majority of the country's rural poor, as well as most of the urban poor living in slums on the outskirts of Baghdad and other major cities. Sunnis had dominated Iraq for centuries, first under Sunni Ottoman rule, then under the British, who, in signature divide-and-rule fashion, favored and governed indirectly through Sunni elites while marginalizing Shias and Kurds. In 1968, the Ba'ath Party took control of Iraq, and, despite its nominal emphasis on secularism and Arab unity, quickly became an organ for Sunni hegemony. But Saddam Hussein, the almost cult-like leader of the Ba'athists, took Sunni favoritism and subjugation of the Shia majority to a whole new level. After becoming president in 1979, Saddam filled the ranks of Iraq's military, civil service, and intelligence with Sunnis. Under his regime, Sunnis, especially from his own hometown and clan, occupied the most powerful government posts and controlled the country's vast oil wealth, with Ba'athists holding the key positions in the nationalized oil company. At the same time, Saddam ruthlessly crushed and persecuted the country's Shias and Kurds. Threatened by the rising influence of Shia clerics and the large Shia population, Saddam banned Shia religious holidays and arrested and executed prominent Shia clergy. Entire Shia villages were burned to the ground, and hundreds of thousands of Shias and Kurds were expelled or killed. After the Kurds and Shias rose up in 1991, Saddam retaliated mercilessly, using chemical weapons and executing untold numbers, including women and children, whose corpses were thrown into mass graves. These were the conditions when U.S. troops invaded in 2003, overthrowing Saddam in a matter of weeks. The Sunnis were a privileged ruling minority, and the Shias, a long-oppressed 60% majority with deep feelings of resentment and a desire for revenge. The dangers of rapid democratization, especially given the recent events in Yugoslavia, should have been obvious. The Shias had a collective axe to grind, and the Sunni minority had every reason to resist and fear majority rule. Yet most of America's foreign policy makers, politicians, and thought leaders seemed to think that the Sunni-Shia divide was no big deal, repeatedly minimizing its significance. There is not a history of clashes that are violent between Sunnis and Shias, Senator John McCain stated in 2003, so I think they can probably get along. Most Arab countries have Shiites and Sunnis, and a lot of them live perfectly well together, said conservative commentator William Crystal. Testifying before the House Budget Committee, then Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz noted that, compared to the Balkans, there has been none of the record in Iraq of ethnic militias fighting one another. These are Arabs, 23 million of the most educated people in the Arab world, who are going to welcome us as liberators. Worse, American policymakers believed that democratization was the solution to Sunni-Shia tensions. Harvard professor Noah Feldman, one of the principal authors of the new Iraqi constitution, expressed confidence that the democratic process would unite Sunnis and Shias. One can predict with some confidence that ordinary politics will eventually take effect, and the Shia will divide into multiple political parties that will, in the end, have to look for Sunni partners to create parliamentary majorities. Sadly, democratization had the opposite effect. Bringing democracy to Iraq. Practically from the moment U.S. troops arrived, Sunni insurgents began waging war against the American invaders who they believed, correctly, would bring the majority Shias to power. The on-the-ground American ignorance of local group conditions is hard to overstate. Only one senior official in the U.S.-led Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, spoke any Arabic. The main selection criteria for staffing the CPA were conservative credentials and loyalty to the Bush administration. Applicants were asked whether they had voted for Bush, and if they supported Roe v. Wade. The CPA's ignorance about Iraq, especially the Sunni-Shia dynamic, resulted in a series of catastrophic decisions. For example, Sunni fears and opposition were exacerbated by the disastrous de-Ba'athification order issued by the CPA in May 2003, which stipulated that anyone in the top four ranks of the Ba'ath Party should be dismissed from their jobs and never allowed to hold public office again. As General Stanley McChrystal put it a decade later, de-Ba'athification reinforced Sunnis' fears that the fall of Saddam would leave them disenfranchised in the face of Shia dominance. De-Ba'athification also stripped the country, already in economic ruin from the war, of desperately needed skills. Hospitals found themselves without doctors, and government ministries lost expertise overnight. But perhaps the worst U.S. decision was disbanding the entire Iraqi army. Overnight, we produced a pool of some 250,000 to 350,000 unemployed, frustrated Sunni men who owned weapons and had no marketable skills other than their military training, leaving them with no means of earning a livelihood. Many of these men joined Sunni insurgency groups, including Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and took up arms against the United States. In 2015, one expert estimated that over 60% of ISIS's most prominent leaders were former Ba'athists. A former Iraqi Army intelligence officer, who lost his job when the army was disbanded, commented that the people in charge of military operations in ISIS were the best officers in the former Iraqi army. Back in 2003, the U.S. solution for this massively unstable state of affairs was immediate democratization. With practically no guidance or knowledge of local conditions, coalition military commanders were ordered to schedule provincial elections and to print ballots. Danger signs appeared immediately. In Najaf, for example, in June 2003, the coalition set up elections, but then, embarrassingly, had to cancel them when it became clear that the most organized political groups in many areas are rejectionists, extremists, and remnants of the Ba'athists. They have an advantage over the other groups. Nevertheless, the United States pressed on with democratization, and in December 2005, 3 days before the country's first national elections, President Bush hailed the upcoming vote as a remarkable transformation for a country that has virtually no experience with democracy and which is struggling to overcome the legacy of one of the worst tyrannies the world has known. He spoke with pride of the hundreds of parties and coalitions that registered for the election and the candidates holding rallies and laying out their agendas across the country. Unfortunately, the political parties that emerged tracked and galvanized Iraq's ethnic and sectarian divisions. Shias voted for Shias, Kurds for Kurds, and Sunnis for Sunnis. As General David Petraeus later put it, the elections hardened sectarian positions as Iraqis voted largely based on ethnic and sectarian group identity. In other words, the 2005 elections did nothing to unite the people or ameliorate sectarian violence. On the contrary, violence quickly escalated. In Baghdad, roaming Shia death squads began terrorizing and murdering Sunnis. At the same time, militant Sunnis commenced their own campaign of terror. One of their leaders, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, declared all-out war on Shias, on democracy, on the coalition, and on America. The 2006 bombing of the Al-Askari Shrine, one of Shia Islam's holiest sites, set off vicious sectarian warfare as furious Shias retaliated by bombing more than 20 Sunni mosques over the next few days. More than 1,000 people died, pushing Iraq to the brink of a Sunni-Shia civil war. What was the United States doing, militarily, in response to this violence? By 2006, the American populace was sick of the war, and the U.S. military was largely in exit strategy mode. The orders from Washington were to minimize U.S. casualties, so most American troops had retreated into sealed-off forward operating bases, FOBs. In other words, as Iraq descended into chaos, U.S. troops were holed up, essentially trying to avoid contact with Iraqis. When a confused soldier in an FOB near Tikrit asked his captain what they were supposed to be doing, his superior replied, "We're here to guard the ice cream trucks going north so that someone else can guard them there." Could we have done better if we hadn't been so blind to tribal politics in Iraq, if we had paid more attention to and worked with the most important group ties and loyalties on the ground? There's very good evidence that the answer is yes. The 2007 surge. In a sea of foreign policy failures, the United States enjoyed a brief moment of success in Iraq when President Bush ordered an influx of 20,000 additional troops in 2007, dramatically reducing sectarian violence and both civilian and U.S. casualties. Most Americans, however, have a very poor understanding of the surge, in part because it's been dragged through the mud of partisan spin and finger-pointing. But the surge is worth examining in detail, because it offers a concrete example of what a more effective, tribal politics-conscious U.S. foreign policy might look like. While the additional U.S. soldiers, sent primarily to Baghdad and Al-Anbar province, were of course a critical factor, the surge succeeded only because it was accompanied by a 180-degree shift in our approach to the local population. For the first time in Iraq, the U.S. military pursued explicitly group-focused, ethnically conscious policies on the ground. The surge was won tribe by tribe, leader by leader, neighborhood by neighborhood. The story begins almost 2 years earlier and involves a then little-known colonel by the name of H.R. McMaster, who would later become National Security Advisor in the Trump administration. In the spring of 2005, McMaster and thousands of troops arrived in the northern Iraqi city of Tal Afar, at the time largely controlled by Sunni insurgents and awash in beheadings and bloodshed. After 2 demoralizing years in Iraq, McMaster had become acutely aware of the failings of U.S. policy. "When we came to Iraq, we didn't understand the complexity, what it meant for a society to live under a brutal dictatorship with ethnic and sectarian divisions. We made a lot of mistakes. We were like a blind man, trying to do the right thing, but breaking a lot of things." Known for being a contrarian, McMaster decided to take a totally different approach, one that tried to understand and work with Iraq's complex group divisions and identities. To begin with, McMaster required his troops to take detailed crash courses in local group customs, practices, and attitudes. As George Packer writes, "The regiment bought dozens of Arab dishdashas, which the Americans call man dresses, and acted out a variety of realistic scenarios, with soldiers and Arab Americans playing the role of Iraqis. Pictures of Shiite saints and politicians were hung on the walls of a house, and soldiers were asked to draw conclusions about the occupants. Soldiers searching the house were given the information they wanted only after they had sat down with the occupants 3 or 4 times, accepted tea, and asked the right questions." McMaster prohibited his soldiers from using derogatory terms like Hajis for Arabs and told them, "Every time you treat an Iraqi disrespectfully, you are working for the enemy." He also had some troops take Arabic language classes and ordered hundreds of copies of The Modern History of Iraq by Phoebe Marr. Moreover, instead of cordoning them off, McMaster sent his troops to interact with the local population, to cultivate trust, and to figure out Tal Afar's complex group dynamics and power structures. One of McMaster's squadron commanders spent 40 to 50 hours a week meeting one-on-one with the leaders of the city's dozens of tribes. First, the Shiite sheikhs, to convince them that the Americans could be counted on to secure their neighborhoods, and then the Sunni sheikhs, many of whom were passive or active supporters of the insurgency. McMaster began building alliances with crucial tribal leaders. He recognized that the only way to defeat the insurgency was to get Sunnis and Shias to work together against the extremists, whose brutality and indiscriminate killing had left a terrorized Tal Afar strewn with headless corpses. His task was enormously difficult. The insurgents were Sunni, and the local Sunni tribes hated and feared the Shias, who controlled the local police. But against all odds, through painstaking, on-the-ground persuasion, often one tribal leader at a time, McMaster succeeded. By driving a wedge between moderate and extremist Sunnis, and by persuading Sunni and Shia tribal sheikhs to cooperate, McMaster and his men cleared Tal Afar of insurgents block by block. Within just 6 months of McMaster's arrival, Tal Afar had stabilized, and sectarian violence had fallen precipitously. Tal Afar was the U.S. military's first successful large-scale counterinsurgency initiative in Iraq, a lonely bright spot in a year of sustained losses. Drawing on McMaster's success, U.S. forces pursued similar tactics in Ramadi, capital of the Al-Anbar province in central Iraq. By 2006, many Anbari Sunnis who originally supported the insurgents had become disgusted with al-Qaeda's savagery and utter disregard for human life. "Anyone who was caught smoking had his or her fingers chopped off," writes retired colonel and now professor Peter Mansour. The corpses of assassinated Iraqis were booby-trapped so that family members coming to collect them for burial would be killed and injured in the process. Moreover, many of al-Qaeda's senior leaders were foreigners, who executed even widely respected Sunni tribal leaders if they refused to cooperate. In what is now known as the Sunni Awakening, many Anbari Sunnis turned against al-Qaeda. Colonel Sean McFarland, a brigade commander in charge of Ramadi, seized this opening. By cultivating and working closely with Sunni tribal sheikhs, McFarland brought one Sunni tribe after another into the U.S. fold. He drew on the talents of men like Captain Travis Patriquin, who spoke Arabic and was highly knowledgeable about Iraqi tribal culture, and who, over countless cups of tea and hundreds of cigarettes, worked magic with the tribal leaders. Patriquin was killed by a roadside bomb in December 2006. Crucially, McFarland and his troops persuaded Sunni chieftains to recruit their fellow tribespeople to serve on new local police forces trained and armed by the U.S. military. It made all the difference to have local police who actually knew the neighborhoods and who could identify the insurgents and criminals. The new police protected local citizens from retaliation by al-Qaeda and provided the U.S. military with cultural savvy and local knowledge that opened the door to enormous amounts of intelligence on al-Qaeda and other insurgent groups. Suddenly, the U.S. military and its partners were able to capture hundreds of al-Qaeda suspects along with large caches of al-Qaeda weaponry. Instead of viewing Iraq's tribes as anachronisms, as the CPA initially did, or dismissing their importance, as Wolfowitz had in 2003, the new leaders of the U.S. effort, such as Brigadier General John Allen, understood that tribal society makes up the tectonic plates in Iraq on which everything rests. With its new Sunni partners, U.S. forces cleared neighborhoods one by one, then gated them, allowing only those with registration cards to enter. By November 2006, The area around Ramadi was largely free of al-Qaeda insurgents, and by summer of 2007, coalition forces had reclaimed much of al-Anbar province. Tal Afar and Ramadi became blueprints for General David Petraeus when he took over command of coalition forces in Iraq, as well as responsibility for the surge, in February 2007. The challenges facing Petraeus at the time could not have been more daunting. The country was still reeling from the sectarian warfare unleashed by the 2006 bombing of the Shia al-Askari Mosque, and nearly 400,000 Iraqis had been forced out of their homes. Violence was at surreal levels, with well over 50 attacks and 3 car bombs per day on average in Baghdad alone. It was clear to Petraeus that the strategy the United States had been pursuing for years in Iraq, basically using overwhelming force to try to kill as many insurgents as possible, was failing. An operation that kills 5 insurgents, he observed, would still be counterproductive if it led to the recruitment of 50 more. Instead, Petraeus adopted the radically different approach pioneered by McMaster and McFarland. As Petraeus saw it, the big idea emerging from Tal Afar and Ramadi was that stability would be achieved by the bottom-up engagement of tribes and other Sunni groups, as well as through the pursuit of top-down reconciliation via the Iraqi government. The focus of the surge was Baghdad, which was on the verge of disintegration and seen by all sides as the key to victory or defeat. The plan embraced by Petraeus was extremely attentive to Iraq's tribal politics. One of the principal documents underlying the surge, a strategy paper by military historian Frederick Kagan of the American Enterprise Institute, included a color-coded map dividing Baghdad district by district, sometimes block by block, into Sunni-dominated, Shia-dominated, and Sunni-Shia-mixed areas. As in Ramadi, U.S. commanders now made a point of using men and women highly knowledgeable about Iraq's ethnic and sectarian dynamics. This included Petraeus's so-called brain trust, academics, journalists, military historians, and military officers, such as the British Brigadier Nigel Aylwin Foster, who, having served in Iraq with the CPA, had been highly critical of the Americans' cultural ineptitude. "If I could sum it up," Aylwin Foster said at the time, "I never saw such a good bunch of people inadvertently piss off so many people." On the ground, the coalition relied increasingly on people like the remarkable Emma Skye, an Oxford-educated Middle East expert who had lived in the region for years, and Lieutenant Colonel Nicky Brooks, who had encyclopedic knowledge of Iraq's groups and subgroups, and who was minutely aware of which tribal leaders were connected to whom. As in Tal Afar and Ramadi, the U.S. military no longer sequestered its troops in safe zone FOBs, nor did it simultaneously try to kill everyone who had ever joined or supported the insurgency. On the contrary, U.S. troops were sent to live among the local people in Baghdad, rather than raiding into the area from remote, secure bases. As Petraeus explained in a 2007 report to Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, "By living among the population, we reinforced the awakening movements already underway and further empowered local communities that decided to reject extremism. We came to more clearly recognize that sheikhs and tribes have important roles to play as key organizing structures in Iraq's culture of honor." Taking a page from the British, the United States pursued a variant of divide and conquer in order to beat back the insurgency. As McChrystal would later put it, they sought out the groups just shy of the most extreme poles and tried to separate them from the irreconcilables, the groups dead set on insurgency. The key, wrote McChrystal, was to feel for the fissures between the groups and rip. Experts today agree that merely deploying 20,000 additional troops would not have been sufficient had American commanders not stopped fighting Iraq's tribal structure and instead started to cooperate with it, building alliances.